Welcome to an episode of Weekly Weights. We lift weights and we are mates. On the weekend we go on dates. Weekly Weights, Jim and Footy.
Weekly Weights with Alex and Will.
Welcome to episode 14 of Weekly Weights. First of all, thanks to Lachlan McDonald, as always, for the theme music. Back to the original today. Love the original.
Yeah, the goat.
The goat. today we're going to be doing a new series. So we'll take it away. What's the new series?
So we're going to go through lift by lift, and we're going to call it programming fixes for the insert lift here. And today's lift is the squat. What we want to do is cover some common technical issues that we see with each of the lifts, some cueing fixes for them, muscular weaknesses that might be associated with them, and then we'll go through specific ways that we can use secondary and accessory exercises to address them, and then we'll also put together some example programs for how we might fix one of them as well. So today's issue, like I said, is the squat, and we've identified five really common technical issues to fix. So going through them, we've got people struggling to hit depth, butt wink, hips shooting back out of the hole or knees shooting back out of the hole, falling onto the toes, and then losing upper back tightness, or as Alex likes to say, shape. So let's go from the top and we'll talk about each of them in more depth as we go through. We'll start with cueing fixes. So Alex, struggling to hit depth, first things first, what is depth?
Depth is breaking the hips below the top of the knee. So hip crease below the top of the knee. That's the rules for powerlifting.
So why is it important?
Well, it's important to follow the rules.
Yeah.
Otherwise your lifts don't count.
So I should actually say here though that even if you're just listening to this not as a powerlifter but as somebody who just wants to actually squat a little bit deeper, which is all well and good, then the tips we talk about today will probably help you. I also think that going for arbitrarily deep squats is not necessarily the best thing to do if it's past like the point at which you can actually squat safely. But if you want to extend that range with which you can squat safely, then try these things. So what are some reasons why somebody might struggle to hit depth, Alex?
Well, first of all, we have to identify, is there enough mobility to hit depth?
Yeah.
So particularly in the hips and in the ankles.
Yeah.
If there is enough mobility, then it's going to be something to do with balance, probably balance, or probably the way we descend, the way we begin our descent.
So I'd hazard that almost everybody actually has adequate mobility to squat to depth, provided that they learn how to use it correctly.
Yep.
Or at least among powerlifters, like you might get, if you get, you know, your geriatric population or something, maybe most of them can't squat to depth. But like, if you're listening to this and you're a competitive powerlifter, you're almost certainly mobile enough to squat to depth because it's just not that hard.
Yeah.
However, yeah, balance and bracing issues really do come out here. And when I say bracing in this instance specifically, I mean actually like setting the pelvis, relative to the ribs and knees. Mm-hmm. So people who start with a huge amount of anterior pelvic tilt, so with their ass sort of shoved out or their back really extended, often struggle to hit depth. And the big reason for that is just because your femur sort of has to move in the socket of your hip and eventually you run out of space. So either your back can round, which we'll cover that when we get to butt wink, either your back can round to let you go deeper or you've got to come up. So that's number one, is just poor bracing. We'll cover how to fix bracing. Mm-hmm. And then like Alex said, number two was issues with the degree to which your knees and hips break. So if you start your squat by shoving the knees forward far too far, eventually you get to the point where you run out of ankle mobility because you're locked to the floor by your feet. So your knees travel too far out over your foot and you either have to tip over forwards or you have to rapidly flex at the hip, which most people prefer not to do because it feels like you're falling forward and you're going to collapse. And so they come up early. And then the opposite can kind of be true. If you sit way back in the hips and your knees don't break, then you can get to the point where to get any deeper, your knee needs to translate forward over your ankle as well. And again, you feel like you're moving forward. So if you don't break well at both the knees and hips together, then you're going to struggle to get to depth.
So as far as cueing that, one thing that I like to do is cue bar over the middle of the foot. And this is something that is extremely important for everything we're going to cover.
Yeah.
But for hitting depth, if the bar is over the middle of your foot, there's going to be a relatively even distribution between knee flexion and hip flexion. So the bar, the hips and knees will be moving away from each other and the bar straight down the middle.
Yeah.
And that will allow us to get the most range out of both so we're able to go the lowest.
So actually, Although I do cue weight over the middle of the foot, like I always cue the 3 points of contact and stuff. When I say 3 points of contact for listeners, I mean like big toe down, little toe down, and heel down. And oftentimes that means telling people to push their big toe down. I always cue that, but I don't just say middle of the foot because it's possible for people to have their knee extended and their hip actually behind the bar and their back arched and still have the bar over the middle of the foot. And Alex, actually, I've said this to you a couple of times that sometimes your squat does this a little bit too much as well. And that actually drives you into more knee flexion during your squat than hip flexion. And it can lead to depth issues as well. I cue people to start their squat stacked. So same thing, I say find that balance point, and then I always try and get people to bring their hips under them. So I sort of say like, you know, ribs down, like abs on, things like that. Start tall, find that weight distribution, and then go from there. But it amounts to the same thing. It's basically your weight actually needs to be centered and your hips need to be underneath you.
Essentially what you're saying is you want to cue pelvic and rib position first and then hip and knee movement after.
Yeah, but I start that process from the floor just like you. So I say like balance first, bring your hips under you, then go.
Mm-hmm.
I don't start at the hips and then say then find your balance again because people just feel wibbly wobbly. I think it always has to come from the ground up.
No.
You don't think
no,
so?
No, I agree.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, well, you felt that really strongly.
No,
there's probably going to be more disagreement than normal on this episode.
I think one, this isn't a cueing fix. This is a, what are we looking at? This is a variation which could help.
Yeah.
Is when you're doing tempo squats, for example.
Yeah.
Because the movement is slower.
Yeah.
You can actually rock back and forward on your feet on the way down and find your midfoot, which I think is actually really helpful. Not for depth reasons, but for other reasons.
I've never in my life asked somebody to deliberately rock backward and forward during a squat.
Not rocking backward and forward, but when you go slower, you will bias towards the heel or the toe.
Yeah, totally. So it exposes
it. So cueing midfoot allows you to sort of find where it is on a descent if the descent is slow enough.
Yeah.
So in this example, in a tempo squat.
Yeah, we'll cover that when we get to variations, but that's definitely something I've found is when you do a tempo squat, it's like suddenly there's a phase of the movement and that will be the phase where you normally shift your weight,
yeah,
where suddenly it's like, holy shit, like I can feel this muscle working that doesn't normally. So for me, when I do a tempo squat, if I do my descent correctly, it's like about a third or two thirds of the way down, or you know, a third or half of the way down, I just start feeling my quads like lighting up like nothing else because that's normally where my weight starts to move back to my heel. I lose that 4 foot pressure.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we'll get onto that when we get onto it. But the first cueing fix is to actually get people stacked and to remove that excessive anterior pelvic tilt.
So once the pelvis is set, then we can cue knees and hips together, bar traveling in a straight line down and up.
Yeah.
And the last cueing fix is speed.
Yeah.
So we need to cue speed after we have proficient movement.
Yeah.
So we need the movement to be good first before we start to talk about tempo and rhythm.
Yeah. So for me, what I tend to do, and I think we spoke about this when we were with the boys at the High Performance Podcast, was that like, although I think rhythm is really important when we squat, it's the last thing I add. So I would always sort of get people moving slowly with light weights first, and sometimes it's even slow on the ascent, but get them moving well, feel out the positions, and then the more confident they are in the position, the more I introduce speed. But initially it mightn't be that control and drop, it'll just be okay, let's go a little faster, and then once they're at like a reasonable tempo, then I'll say okay, control and drop.
Yeah, that's one thing that JP says a lot: move fast, learn slow, and vice versa.
Yeah, I was gonna say I thought he said the opposite way, but yeah,
no, he does say move fast, learn slow.
Yeah, well, it makes sense.
Move slow, learn fast, in reverse.
So the way I explain this to people, there's like an inverse relationship between movement speed and precision. And the easiest example that you can bring to mind when you think about it is the old trick of like stabbing a knife between your fingers if you just lay them out on like a wall or a table. And if you go really slowly, you're never in any danger of actually stabbing your fingers. Like you could have the sharpest knife in the world and you'd never be worried. But the second you start to introduce speed, you become less precise in where you stab that knife in, right? And that sort of relationship is demonstrable across a huge number of tasks. So even for things that are maybe relatively simple, like the power lifts, when you're trying to coordinate lots of things moving together relatively precisely, probably the best way to start is just to reduce demands, number one, but then do things slowly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So as speed increases, accuracy decreases.
Yeah, exactly.
So we want to reduce the error
yeah
by moving well
Yeah.
So move well first and then start to add rhythm and speed.
Yeah. Now, okay, what we didn't cover, although we actually spoke about this in depth in episode one, is why speed is important to prevent people cutting depth. So why is it important?
Well, if you travel for 2 seconds on the way down and you're going faster in one instance and slower in the other instance, you're going to go further in the faster instance.
I mean, that's like, yeah, that's totally true.
So if you're,
that doesn't actually explain why they would go deeper. Why wouldn't they just cut higher? Because that's where they squat to.
If the time is the same on the way down, and in one instance you're going faster, you will go lower. So yeah. We've seen this, like...
But you could say the same about a car going down the road, and you're not saying, why is the car going further down the road? You're saying it's going faster, so it went further in 2 seconds. But, like, it goes further because it's propelled further or something. Like, why does somebody squat deeper just because they go faster?
I don't understand what you mean.
I'm saying, like, the time that they take on their descent, why would the time be the same whether they go, like, whether they move fast or slow? Why wouldn't they just stop at the same point and get there faster if you descend faster?
I'm not sure what you mean.
Okay. So, sorry, I've bamboozled Alex here. I think descending a little bit quicker into the hole helps people go deeper, but I don't think it's because you're going to descend for a constant time no matter what, and the faster you go, the more distance you cover, because that just seems silly to me. I think, like, if there was actually something restricting you going deep, you would stop at the same degree of knee and hip flexion every time in your squat. I think that maybe the reason that going faster helps into the hole is because when you go slow, you're probably, like, wasting more energy actually decelerating the bar rather than getting the stretch reflex lower where you naturally would.
Definitely.
And so I think that sort of extra effort in decelerating the bar probably translates to you cutting the bar higher, or cutting the squat higher than you normally would. Whereas when you brace, create stability, and then go down with a bit more speed, it's at your sort of, like, natural, you know, mechanical, like, reversal point, or where the stretch reflex kicks in, that you'll reverse rather than where it gets hard to continue to decelerate the bar.
Yeah,
I think there is a point, and it's pretty much the sticking point in the squat where muscular effort, like, where you're most mechanically inefficient, right? And that's just out of the hole for most people. It's what's the degrees that Wilksy says of knee flexion?
28.
Wilks loves to say 28 degrees of... is it 28 degrees above parallel?
Yeah, 28 degrees above.
Yeah, so I reckon you start to get to that point, and when you've got a really artificially slow descent, because that's where you're most mechanically inefficient, it's probably also really hard when you're doing heaps of muscular input to slow the bar down, to continue to, like, slow the bar down through and past that point. And so I think rather what you need to do is, like, create tension, position yourself well, and then let yourself hit your natural depth where, yeah, the stretch reflex kicks in and powers you out of the hole. That's what I think.
Yeah, you kind of just fall into position.
Yeah.
Into the bottom. Not fall, but... You know,
yeah, but like
control
as
control yourself into the position.
Yeah, you control yourself into the position rather than, like, sort of arbitrarily slowing you down to the point where you're like, wow, I really can't maintain this positioning further. I'm going to come back up.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So that's what I meant when I was just ragging on Alex because I thought that was a funny way of saying it. Have we got anything else to say about depth? No, I'd say
no, not. I think that's about it.
Okay. What about butt wink then? So first things first, Alex, what is butt wink?
So butt wink is when the pelvis goes into, well, from neutral to posteriorly tilted, and your hips come under you, right in the bottom of the hole.
Yeah.
And why is this bad, Will?
I think a small amount of pelvic tilt isn't necessarily bad, but a large amount is, and partly because it's dangerous for the back. That's probably the most important reason, to be honest.
Why is it dangerous for the back?
Like moving your spine under load, particularly under compressive load, from, you know, either neutral into heaps of extension, or extension through neutral, or neutral into flexion, any of them is not good. Mm-hmm. So ideally you want a relatively stable spine under load, and for most of your squatting you should be able to achieve the required range of motion, like, for your femur without you having to actually move your pelvis to accommodate it. Why would butt wink occur though?
Why would it occur?
Yeah.
Generally because of poor pelvic position from the start.
Yeah.
So if you start yourself in an anterior tilt, you're going to run out of room like you were talking about earlier, and then you're going to tilt under.
Yeah. So that's my main reason that I would see butt wink as well, is basically people who are unable to brace correctly often start with heaps of extension. I think it's really natural, particularly when you're back squatting, because you've got a weight on your back, you're like, you sort of have a drive to actually extend against it. So, you know, you're trying to push your back hard into the bar. And yeah, people who start in that overextended position basically run out of hip room, and in the pursuit of more depth, they roll their pelvis in underneath them. I also think that when you learn to brace correctly, because you create more stability, often your femur will actually free up to go into greater degrees of hip flexion. I'm no movement guru, but in general, the more stable you are, the more range you tend to get. So learning to brace correctly will also just buy you a tiny bit more hip flexion range. The other thing we spoke about when we were sort of nutting out this episode, though, was that for some people, their stance might just be a little bit inappropriate. And so oftentimes you do require a stance adjustment to fix butt wink. Alex, why don't you run us through? You were saying like people with a narrow stance often demand a little bit more of like the ankle and knee.
Mm-hmm.
And then people with a wider stance demand more of the hip. Can you actually explain that a bit further?
In terms of butt wink?
Yeah, like let's start with butt wink. When would you make a stance adjustment?
To be honest, that wouldn't be the first thing I would do.
Okay. So first thing you would do is what?
Fix pelvic movement.
Yeah.
And bracing into the ribs. All right. So the pelvis and the ribs have a relationship that is sort of
Alex is holding his fingers up I guess you can see it through the microphone.
Two parallel lines.
Yeah.
So as the parallel lines move down the squat, they stay parallel the whole way.
Yeah.
So if we have if we're closed off or we're opened up, we don't want either of those things. So we want those two parallel lines the whole way. So that's a cueing thing.
Yeah.
And that's just technical. So bracing the position first.
Yeah.
And then being able to hold the position first. That's the first thing I would teach.
Okay.
When would you make a stance adjustment?
Okay. So firstly, my rationale for why stance adjustments might be appropriate. Everybody's hip is oriented a little bit differently. So your pelvis, the acetabulum, which is the little socket that your femur actually sits into, points in different directions on different people. And there's like an ethnic basis for it. So I think Asian people's ones are oriented a little bit more. Narrowest and point forward. And then there's something called like the Scotch hip or whatever, where it's like pointed way, way out to the side. And so for that reason, because the actual socket itself, you're going to have to imagine it for yourself and like cup your hand and create a little rim. Depending on where that is facing, you're actually going to have more room for movement within it for the femur, right? So some people will actually be able to flex their femur further, which means they'll be able to bring their leg towards their belly further with it pointing directly ahead of them. And some people will be able to do it with their leg way, way out to the side, right? So your hip flexion range is partly determined by how much space you actually have in that capsule. And that's something that's sort of inter-individually different. So I think what happens, maybe less often than it used to, but I've had a client, you remember Michael that I trained at Bondi? Okay, well, shout out Michael, he probably doesn't listen to this. But a lot of people who are probably introduced to powerlifting through equipped powerlifting think that having a wider stance might be advantageous because it like the wider your stance is, the less movement there is in the sagittal plane, so forward and backward. And so lots of people go for like an artificially wide stance, but what happens is they run out of hip flexion room because their hip just isn't oriented very well for them to hit depth like that. And so often bringing the stance in a little bit actually buys them a little bit more hip flexion room and also allows them to like break at the knee appropriately and things. And the reverse can be true as well. You can have people whose stance is just a little bit too narrow or whose feet are just a little bit too straight, where when you turn their feet out a little bit and bring their knees just a tiny bit wider, suddenly they can actually comfortably find depth because anatomically that's just more appropriate for them.
And usually you'll notice this from watching from the front.
Yeah.
You'll see someone when they get to depth and what's going on at the knees and the hips is usually an indication of where they need to be.
Like, as in if the knee and ankle and hip sort of like move synchronously.
If they're not in alignment, we obviously want them to be.
As in the knee and the ankle?
And the hip, yeah.
Yeah, agreed.
So if there's something that's off, we can sort of make a small adjustment and see how it looks again. Yeah. I think generally what is the best stance and foot position as far as how turned out and straight our foot would be, it comes down to what is comfortable.
Yeah.
So like generally, whatever is comfortable for the lifter is probably the right choice.
Yeah. But
it's going to be comfortable because of their hip structure.
Yeah.
And because of the mobility that they're able to, that they have.
Yeah. I didn't actually answer your question really, really well though. So my answer to when to make a stance adjustment is if like you actually think they're vaguely bracing correctly and like the patterning's not awful, but they're still struggling to hit depth, and particularly if their stance is like egregiously different from just normal, then that's when I'd start to be like, hey, like, you know, let's try tucking your legs in a little bit more. And usually it doesn't take long to be like, wow, that stance looks pretty comfortable, particularly if you're not using like maximal loads. Like you're not going to move 100% great when you adjust your stance, but you'll probably notice at like 60 or 70%, like, hey, this move's pretty comfortable.
Yeah.
And that's been my experience.
For me, I think it's something that you kind of just learn. Like you learn what a good squat looks like, and then you kind of see like, oh, that's slightly off and it's because of this. So you just kind of have a go.
Yeah.
And then you'll find the right answer eventually.
Yeah, it's actually much harder to articulate this than it is to just see it.
Definitely.
But anyway, this is good practice. Good fun. All right, next issue. Hips shooting back, or as Alex says, knees shooting back. So what is it? Why has it happened to me?
To you.
Yeah, what is it and why has it happened?
You want to answer it?
Yeah, you go.
Oh, you want me to go?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So as we get into the bottom of the squat, we want our hips and knees to move together the same way that they broke on the way up.
Yeah.
So we want the way down and the way up to look the same.
Yeah.
So if we're breaking evenly on the way down and we're not coming evenly on the way up, this is probably what it is. So it's going to be the knee shifting back, the hip shooting up, and generally the bar will tip forward.
Okay. I don't think the bar has to tip forward, but I pretty much agree.
Generally.
Yeah, okay. I'll get on to that. The bar doesn't have to tip forward, but it often happens as well. I'll tell you why it often happens biomechanically in a moment. But first things first, why do the knees shoot back? So basically, again, this is harder if you don't have any background in biomechanics. There's a great article, which I think Greg Knuckles wrote, it's on Stronger by Science, his website, that talks about good morning in your squats. Do you know what I'm talking about? It says like, why do you good morning your squats or something?
Yeah, I think so.
It's got figures and things. So if you're finding what I'm saying hard to follow, then Google Stronger by Science, good morning squats. Have a read of that article. It's quite good. But when you're in the bottom of your squat, right, you've got the weight that should be sitting directly over your feet. And then in front of that bar, you have your knees, and behind that bar, you have the hips, right? And your body and your femur, or like your torso and your femur, are kind of levers, and they're operating around your knee and your hip, right? And so the bar is basically trying to fold those joints closed further. Your bar is trying to fold you into more hip flexion, so it's trying to bring your femur towards your tummy, and it's trying to fold you into knee flexion. It's trying to bring your knee closer to your calf, right? And your muscles have to work to extend against that. So your quadricep has to work to straighten your knee, and you know, your glutes have to work to bring your hip back under your shoulders, or bring your hip through and stop your body folding over. And so often what happens is people who have weaker quadriceps can take away a little bit of the knee extension demands by bringing their knee back towards the midline. So your knee shoots back underneath you, right, which allows you to straighten your knee. So it takes your quadricep from a really stretched, not as strong position, and it shoves your hip into more flexion. So it bends you over a little bit more at the hips. That's why we call it a good morning squat. So it's basically saying, my legs aren't particularly strong, I'm gonna shift some load from my legs onto my hips, and then it requires a lot more of your hips and back to stand back up again. But the biggest, most obvious reason is basically because your quads aren't strong enough to do the work, or your legs aren't strong enough to do the work. As for why this often leads to the bar falling forward a little bit, in my opinion, the reason is because as your hips have shot back, right, your back angle changes, you have to lean forward more, and that becomes really hard on your upper back, because again, you've got your back working as a lever, but it's not just like, your back's not just one sort of solid object, it's a whole bunch of spinal segments, and they're supported by muscles themselves, right? There's muscles that run across all of them, and muscles that run in between them that work to actually sort of hold your back straight or in extension. And as your back sort of flattens out, the bar's sort of pushing down on you like a lever there, and you have to create more and more force because the distance between your hip and that bar is extended, and so that long lever means there's more torque on your back. And so what happens is people's upper back starts to round because their hips have shot back, so they're no longer as upright, right? So their back's having to produce more extension force. Upper back starts to round, upper back rounds, and the bar sort of starts to roll forward, and it moves out across their foot. And then suddenly you've got a knee that's shot back, so you don't have your legs working with you anymore, a hip that's having to do lots of work, and a back position that's compromised. And that's like the ultimate bad squat that you're pretty much going to miss.
So essentially the bar is further from the hip.
Yeah, the bar's further from the hip.
And why is that bad?
In that instance, it's bad because your hips are now in a closed position. They're not in a really strong place to power you out of the bottom of the hole. Your quads should actually be in a strong place to power you out of the bottom of the hole. That's bad. But the main reason that it's bad is because your upper back starts to give out. And once your back is giving out, you can't support the load enough to do hip extension and stand a bar up. And so you miss your squat.
Agreed.
All
right, cues.
Cues. Okay, so...
There are three that I use.
Yeah, you do your three.
So one of them is knees forward. Probably my favorite one.
Knees forward when?
Right at the bottom of the hole.
Okay.
Sorry, right in the hole. Yep. Hold your knees forward. Yeah. So generally, this will keep the bar over the midfoot. Bar can travel straight up. Yeah. If we have the strength in the quad.
Yes.
Drive your knees forward. Second one, chest up.
Yeah.
Good old classic.
Shout out. Try to,
as you hit the bottom, so not on the way down, do not get your chest up on the way down because you'll go into extra extension, which we don't want, which we spoke about earlier.
Yeah.
It's as we hit the bottom, we want to drive the chest up to prevent us from going into spinal flexion.
Yeah.
And the other one is push the bar back.
Yeah.
So you'll see this with people who tip forward like very aggressively.
Yeah.
If you can push the bar back behind you and think about sort of like...
You almost like throw it
almost
off
your back. Like pushing... Yeah, almost like pushing the bar into the wall behind you.
Yeah.
That can keep the bar straight up.
So I can add a pretty personal touch to this because this is probably... It's probably my biggest squat technical issue. It's not to say it's my only one, but this is my biggest one. So thinking knees forward is really helpful for me. It's one that I've used for myself and with my clients. And I like saying push the bar, push your bar back. I don't necessarily say chest up, although it can help. I just think it achieves the same thing as push the bar back. And I like external cues like that. But another one that Alex hasn't touched on is the importance of weight distribution. And this is something he cues to all his lifters. So it's not because he doesn't do it. It's just because it's already taken care of. When you have this problem, oftentimes what happens is you move from an even weight distribution across your foot to driving too much through the heel. Right, and once you're driving too much through the heel, there's not actually sort of any pressure in the ground happening just ahead of the kneecap, which you actually need to use your quad effectively. I don't know how well I've said that, but something that I think about is driving my big toe down and actually keeping some forefoot pressure. And if you combine forefoot pressure, knees forward, and bar like back into the bar, then you do a lot better job of using your quads. So in this instance, this is actually a time where, rather than thinking like drive your heels down or something, I would think like, you know, grab the floor with your foot or like forefoot pressure and really try and hold it. And particularly holding it in your descent will stop you shifting back onto your heel. Because once you're back on your heel, you're going to really, really struggle to use your quad effectively. So yeah, Alex?
So essentially what we want to do is create a position before we've even descended.
Yeah.
And sort of, I guess, pressure.
Yeah.
Before we've even descended, that we want to maintain throughout the entire squat.
Yeah, exactly.
So we want pressure through the feet, we want pressure in the bar, and we want pressure in our belt.
Yeah.
So what's pressure in the feet going to do, Will?
Well, exactly what I've said there. So
So from that, pressure in the belt, what's pressure in the belt going to do?
It holds your brace.
Yeah.
Yeah, and allows you to stop folding forward a little bit.
And then what's pressure in the barbell going to do?
So again, that upper back tightness does that, like helps you with the pushing the bar back thing.
Yeah. So if we're talking about three things that could probably make your squat great, it's pressure. Pressure in three places. So pressure in the, I guess, what I call the three contact points. So a contact point being the floor, the barbell, and in our belt.
Yeah.
So if we're able to maintain pressure through the descent, and as we hit the hole and out of the hole, the squat should be great, and you should never miss a squat other than you're too weak.
Yeah.
If you're able to do all of those things, and that's really the only way you should ever miss. If you miss from a technical cue, that kind of sucks.
Yeah.
But it's something to go, obviously something to work on.
Yeah.
But that's what we want. Is the only way we want to miss is literally there's too much weight on the bar.
Yeah, I mean, I agree, but I also think that what happens when there's too much weight on the bar is that it exposes technical weaknesses. Because what might happen, say, is like, you know, like I can make a 70% squat look pretty great because my quads aren't too weak at 70%. But when you get to 90%, 95%, 100%, suddenly it might be that, you know, your glutes are strong enough, your back is strong enough, but your quads only have 90% of your best squatting you. And that's when those issues start to be exposed. So it's like, though I agree in an ideal world, you do a perfectly, like you do a technically perfect squat and you miss because you're not strong enough. In the real world, yeah, what I think happens
missing because your legs aren't strong enough is missing because you're not strong enough.
Yeah, but I mean, in that case, what you just said is pretty much a truism. It's like the only way you could miss otherwise is like misadventure. There's an earthquake mid-squat.
You could completely fuck up your pressure in your feet, for instance. Like, you could completely fuck up your brace.
Sure.
You could completely lose your back tension.
Yeah.
That's not because you're too weak.
Yeah, you
cooked it. That's because you did something wrong.
Yeah, but that's just
what I said.
Oh, okay. Sorry, I misinterpreted you. I thought you meant that like everything should always look perfect and then you just miss because you're not strong enough. Whereas really what happens is everything looks perfect till you're not strong enough to do it perfectly.
Yeah, but then
you're not, and then you start to miss.
But then you're not strong enough. Which is why you missed. Not because you cooked it.
Yeah, but this is potentially the dumbest argument ever. Why is it not perfect? Because you're not strong enough. So what do you do? You get stronger.
No, you're not understanding what I'm saying.
No, it's very hard to. Go on.
So you're saying that, you know, your back and your glutes are stronger than your quads. So
yes.
You're going to miss the squat. Even if you do everything perfectly, you're going to miss the squat because your quads aren't strong enough.
Yeah, I'm saying that not...
That is literally you being not strong enough, which is exactly what I said.
Yeah, but all I...
Like, not that you cooked it.
Yeah, but the impression I got was that you were saying that, like, everything will fail at once. And that's not true.
What happens is
things progressively fail.
That's not what I said.
And that's what people call, like, that's what a weak point is. So unless you just cook it, everybody has a weak point. And the idea is minimize your weak points or maximize your strong points, minimize your weak points by learning to do the lift correctly and then programming intelligently to fix them.
Of course.
Yeah. So I'm right.
You're...
All right. The other thing I want to talk about with hips shooting back, is the importance of the descent, pretty much for the reasons that Alex said. So...
So again, I'm right now, am I?
Yeah, in this instance, Alex is right. Okay, you can take that one to the bank, Alex. First time for everything. So again, if your rhythm in the knees and hips in your descent is poor, then oftentimes that will lead to like a misdistribution of weight over the foot, and then that makes it harder to actually maintain that ideal knee and hip position. So again, I think actually building a good descent pattern and good strength in the descent will set you up to lift the bar well. And something that Alex and I have spoken about a number of times with each other is that, like, pretty much in all of the lifts, like, well, okay, in the squat and bench, for instance, if you lower the bar properly, then the lift is easier. You basically need to put yourself in a position at the bottom of the lift to be strong. And then the deadlift, the only reason it's any different is because you don't get to lower the bar first, and the start position is the most important thing. If you're in the right start position, then you give yourself a really good chance to actually lift well. So the squat's exactly like that as well, is you actually need to put a big amount of effort, or as big of an effort, into lowering the bar effectively as you can, to lower the bar effectively so that you can actually lift it effectively. If you just sort of flop into the bottom of your squat and then try very hard, you're going to fuck it up more often than not.
I think the descent is more important than the ascent in the squat by a mile.
Why is that?
Because like what we've said, if we're able to create the environment to succeed from the start, that's what's going to carry us through the back to the top.
Yeah.
So if we are able to find our pelvic position, we're able to have pressure in all three spots, and we're able to maintain that throughout the descent, we're going to have a much, much easier time coming up.
Yeah, I think that's probably why, off topic now, but I think that's why the squat's probably got like, I reckon the... probably a bigger mental game to it than the bench and deadlift. Like deadlift, you just grab on and try really hard. But squat, it actually, like, I don't know, it takes a lot more balls, I guess, or a lot more, like, you know, courage to, you know, get yourself really tight, dominate the bar from the rack, and actually, like, accelerate into the hole and really take it for a ride. I think the second you get tentative, it punishes you a lot more. And it's scary because, like, you can get crushed.
You have to treat it like, you know, it's your first warm-up.
Yeah, but the problem is it's not. It's really heavy
and
hard.
Yeah, and you have to walk it out, which obviously adds to the stress and difficulty.
Yeah, and there's something much scarier about having the weight on your back like that than having the bar in your hands, particularly if your bench is little.
Yeah, and the other...
Come on.
The other thing is, when you miss a deadlift, you just drop the bar and it's over.
Yeah.
When you miss a squat, you literally get crushed.
Yeah, exactly.
It's terrifying.
So it is scary. All right, hip shooting back.
In conclusion, don't do powerlifting.
Yeah, probably stick to something else. Okay, falling onto toes. So What is it? Why is it a problem?
So essentially, this is where we have too much forefoot pressure.
Yeah.
And you'll usually see this in the hole. Why is this a problem? Because the bar will come forward and we don't have pressure through the heel. Therefore, we're not very stable through the foot. Therefore, we can't really use our legs.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you can kind of use your legs when you're on your toes, I would say, but you can't use your hips. It's like, it was a bit like I was saying when you're falling onto your heels, you can't use your quads, but you can use your hips a bit. If you fall onto your toes, you're not using your hips. Like, stand on your toes and then try and do like a really powerful hip extension. It's actually kind of hard. Yeah, it's exactly that. Like, we cue hip extension oftentimes by teaching people to like drive their heel into the ground because it helps them. So yeah, falling onto the toes sucks. And yeah, you'll fall forward and your back will collapse and you'll miss your squat. And if it's heavy, you're just imbalanced. Like, there's, yeah, you're going to fall over. What causes it though? Because I don't, like, in this instance, I don't think falling onto the toes is really like a muscular weakness.
No, agreed.
I think it's like patterning or inflexibility.
Yeah, potentially inflexibility through the ankle, which is probably pretty rare. If you do see someone where their heels actually come up off the floor,
yeah,
then you might want to put them in a shoe.
A shoe, meaning like a heel shoe.
Weightlifting shoe, yeah.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's probably just got to do with balancing the foot pressure in the descent. So having even pressure through the heel and the two contact points at the front of the foot.
Yeah, so again, for me, I sort of see this sometimes with people who drive their knees forward too far in the descent because you just run out of like ankle room. And then like usually what happens is people fall forward a little bit or they just choose to stand up. But sometimes they'll like keep going down and their heel will just raise progressively. And then, yeah, less common would be like if you sort of start with your hips going back way too far and then you have that late knee drive forward and you're just falling forward onto your toe. Yeah. But in that case, yeah, it's pretty much balanced. So if you learn to actually create pressure, like Alex likes to say, and then just control your descent, you'll do better. Mm-hmm. Okay, last one that we spoke about and we have kind of covered it is upper back tightness. Or Alex, do you like to say shape? Why do you like to say shape instead of tightness?
I think shape is probably a better representation of like what is actually going on.
Like what you're trying to achieve.
Yeah, so we want neutral spine. So we've spoken about pelvic shape. That's essentially the bottom of the spine.
Yeah.
So we want neutral spine throughout the rest of the spine, essentially.
Yeah.
So if we fall into too much extension or too much flexion, it can pull the bar away from the middle of the foot and then we're going to have to balance somewhere else and then something else is going to give out.
Let me play devil's advocate because our friend JP, I think JP is the most mentioned person on the show that hasn't been on the show. Shout out JP, you can come on the show one day. He actually put out a video saying why T-spine extension in the squat is important, and he made a pretty good point, which is basically that it brings the bar a little bit closer to the hips. So in the same way that the bar falling further from the hips when your back rounds is bad, having your upper back extended brings it closer to the hips. So why is it necessarily that we want a neutral spine through the upper back?
Well, why would you say that you want to extend your spine when before you were saying you don't cue chest up?
I don't cue chest up out of the hole because I think cueing push the back into the bar out of the hole does the same thing, and external cues are generally better than internal cues. Why do I not cue chest up on the descent? I don't cue chest up on the descent because I think it often teaches people a bad pattern. Because if you try and keep your chest artificially high on the descent, then usually what happens is you just fall over later. Either because it caused you to drive your knees up too early or it caused you to fall back on your heel during your descent trying to keep your chest up. So I don't like to cue chest up for pretty much any of the squat. That said, I do think trying to sort of... You almost need to like dissociate your lumbar spine. So pretty much everything below the ribcage from your thoracic spine. And so in this instance, like I'll cue people like ribs down, squeeze your hips, set your abs, all that stuff. But then I do actually want them to sort of pull the bar down onto their back. And I almost like, I think of like bringing my sternum to my face. So you do get that tiny bit of thoracic spine extension. But it's not going to be a big movement. And if you think too much about chest up, all that happens is you sort of start to do it from the lower back.
Yeah. I think it's more of, a cue to prevent you from doing what is inevitably going to happen, which is going to be upper back flexion, which we don't want. So it kind of, in a way, keeps you neutral.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
By virtue of being pulled down by the load.
Right. I actually think more important than the actual extending your upper back part, though, is probably just creating like a good shelf.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I'll tell people like when the bar's on their back in the rack to almost like row it down onto themselves, really squeeze their scaps back in together. And then standing there, like I said, I like to brace floor up. So I say, you know, foot pressure, grab the belt, all of that. And then I tell people elbows in. So I don't like that whole roll your elbow forward under the bar thing. I think it's stupid. But I'll tell them to squeeze the bar and pull your elbows in like you're finishing a lat pull down, and then you can drive them forward just a tiny bit, and that really cranks your upper back and your lats tight. I think doing that sets you, like Alex said, sets you back and prevents rounding. So I think it's more important maybe to prevent rounding than to extend. But once you've done that, if you can bring your chest to your face just a tiny bit, then I also think that's helpful, and that's like the tightest position you can be in.
One way that I like to put it is that the back is kind of just holding us in place, and the legs are what is responsible for finishing the lift for us.
Yeah.
So if we take away from our ability to use our legs, we're then relying on our back to squat, which we don't want to do.
Yeah.
So essentially, we want our back to hold our position so that we're able to use our knees and our hips to squat.
Yeah, I can pretty much agree with that entirely. And so when
so that's why we talk about shape. So maintaining shape of the back. So like we spoke about before with the parallel lines.
Yeah.
It's the same idea. If we're able to maintain that throughout, we don't have any chinks anywhere.
Yeah, so it's basically you're letting your legs do their job as best they can.
Bend your knees, push your hips back, and then do the same thing on the way up. Very simple. And let everything
else do the same thing. You've got to unbend your knees.
Yeah,
exactly that. We'll take a very quick break. But yeah, anyway, the break music today is stuff that I recorded with the mate's feet loco, or my mate's feet loco on Saturday when we were having drinks. Hope you enjoy it.
What? Two, buckle your shoes.
A weekly wait with your mates. Gripping interviews delivered to you. Competitions optimize your positions.
Weekly waits.
No wilks in the jungle.
Weekly waits with your mates. We're back talking about programming for the squat, or just fixing the squat. And we were going to run through how we would go about structuring training to fix somebody with the problem of the hips or knees shooting back in the squat. Alex, take it away.
So this is probably the most common squat error that we see, I would say.
Yeah, probably.
So we've identified that if it is a muscular weakness, it's in the quadriceps.
Yeah, pretty much invariably, yeah.
So what we need to do is bias our leg training in particular to the quadriceps. So you might probably reduce your hip and glute volume a little bit and replace that with additional quad volume to sort of bring up that, sort of bridge the gap between the disparity. As far as like, I guess the first thing that we would do is build hypertrophy.
Yeah.
So if a muscle is weak, it's probably small.
Yeah.
So a big muscle is probably stronger than a small muscle. So we should probably get that muscle a bit bigger first.
Yeah, okay.
So I guess in the early stages of a competition cycle, maybe in the 8-week hypertrophy block, we would do a lot of higher volume squatting.
Yeah.
Lots of 10s, 8s, etc.
Yeah.
And as we get closer and closer to the competition, we'll obviously have to get closer and closer to the competition variant, so we're not going to be able to fit in as much direct quad work.
Yeah.
What other questions do you have?
Well, I guess, actually, I have two questions. I forgot the first one, but the second one is, how does this even differ from normal? So like you're saying, like preparatory stages, you need to do high volumes. Every time we talk about programming, we say you got to do high volumes in prep stages. Yeah. So how's this biased towards fixing this issue in the squat? Like, what would you do differently?
Well, I guess the exercises you choose,
yeah,
they're going to be closer to something that's a little bit more knee dominant,
yeah,
to hip dominant.
Yeah.
And we're going to probably take out a little bit of deadlift volume.
Okay, so why would you take out deadlift volume to fix this?
Because we can only do so much volume.
Yeah, so
we can't just add volume, and we can't just add volume into a program, like into any program. We can't just add in, you know, an extra.
Do more.
Yeah, exactly.
Because
right.
You're already presumably doing an appropriate amount.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So if we have a disparity between quad and hip,
yeah,
we should probably take away some hip to even it out a little bit.
Right. But it's not making the hip weaker deliberately. It's literally just you can only hack so much work, so you bias that to where you can do it.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's the same rationale that we would use with someone who has like maybe a lagging bench press. We might cut out a bit of their lower body volume to bring up their upper body type of thing.
Right. But okay, actually that's a really good instance to talk about, because there's obviously like an overall package of how much work you can do, or you know, how much volume you can recover from. Shout out Mike Isratel. But there's also got to be an amount that a given muscle or a given movement pattern can hack. And yep. So I'm leery of necessarily saying that, you know, say with the lower body, upper body thing, of saying
lower just... Lower body, upper body, shout out Jason.
Yeah, Genova, Genova, whatever. I'm leery of saying that just because you're not doing leg work, you can handle heaps more upper body work. I think the contribution is probably small.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Similarly,
it would be in the measure of a few sets a week.
Yeah, and I think the same might be true for quads and hip stuff. Like if you're already doing an appropriate amount of volume, it might be that you're doing 10 sets of squats a week and you can handle 12 if you do a few less deadlifts. Mm-hmm. But I think if you were to jack it up and do like 18,
yes,
in the name of getting your quads stronger, all that would happen is you'd do too much and be shit and wouldn't be able to actually progress.
Yes, agreed.
So it's sort of like you bias your volume there, but you still have to progress or else you're not doing anything.
Yes.
You're just doing more, less.
Yes. So if we look at... variations that we would use.
Yeah.
So what are some squat variations we can use that are going to be more knee dominant to the low bar comp squat?
So high bar and front squats are immediately good options. Probably high bar better than fronts, just because front squats for most people, the upper back starts to give out. So I use front squats in my programming for people, a little bit for quad work, but usually when I like want something that's deliberately less overloading, just because you handle way less weight. So like tiny bit of extra quad volume, nowhere near as much weight, not as fatiguing. High bars, I think, are like a go-to for this type of thing. If there's a patterning issue, then things like tempo squats are really good. But high bars are great. Safety bar squats are pretty similar to low bar squats. That, and then things like, you know, leg presses, lunges, like general quad work.
Mm-hmm.
You?
Agreed.
Yeah. So
it's not really a very difficult question, is it?
Like get your quads stronger and learn how to squat. Well, no, this is probably part of the really important one is, so what do you do with your competition squat to fix this technical issue?
If you had a long time for a competition, you might go away from the competition squat entirely, or you may just put in a little bit of tempo work.
Yeah.
To sort of, I guess, teach yourself how to squat again. But the goal has to be the goal. And if the goal of the block is to get your quads stronger, sack your comp squats for a little bit, because they're the ones that are sort of that have that problem.
So I remember on the peaking program comparison episode, we had a little tiff.
Mm-hmm.
Love a stiff. And and I was saying that I like the knee extension demands of the low bar squat are pretty similar to high bar squats for the most part. It's just that you handle more weight because you also use your hip more.
Well, a lot of my lifters will do high bars in heels and low bars in flats. They'll do their competition lift in flat shoes. And then because I want more out of the quadricep, I want more knee travel.
Yeah.
I'll get them in heels for the high bars. So then that creates a little bit more of a difference between the two.
Sure, but I guess if you're failing because of quad strength in both, then you're going to fail when your knee has to produce pretty much the same amount of, like, as in when your knee has to extend with the same amount of force in both.
Yeah, agree.
So to me, it's sort of like, why not do some sub-max competition squat work? And by sub-max in this instance, I don't mean just like if you can do 10 reps, you should be doing 6 or 7s. I mean like sub-max where you can do 10 reps with perfect form. So you do 7s or 8s with perfect form. Why not do that and repattern it, because you're still going to put a significant amount of work through your quads doing it.
Yeah, there's no reason why we can't do that.
So like something I might prefer then in this type of thing is to have one day where you might do your competition squat pretty sub-max and then just hammer some general quad work.
Mm-hmm.
And then another day where you might do your secondary squatting, which might be high bar squats plus minus some tempo squats, where your squat pattern is like, you know, really shifted to the quads a little bit. And then, you know, still hammer away at your work. But like, I think there's value to honing technique on the competition lift. It's just that the proportion of your work that's put to that should be relatively low, because you can only do so much quad work on there without, you know, taxing other body parts, and because it's more efficient maybe to use the other lifts.
Yeah, I agree with that. But if we have a long enough time, we can go away from the competition variant entirely.
Yeah, and then reintroduce it.
And then reintroduce it and get that technique back quite quickly. And like you said, the technical demands on the quads are quite similar in the high bar and the low bar.
Yeah.
So it's not like you're not squatting. It's not like you're doing leg presses only for 8 weeks or something.
Sure. I mean, if you're deliberately
it's
also...
It's not that different.
Yeah, but if you're deliberately taking away some of your hip, this is why I actually think this probably in more important terms. If you're deliberately taking away some of, say, your deadlift volume, which is hip and back intensive, your low bar squat has a similar amount of quad contribution and probably, like, as in at the point at which you fail, and probably has more hip and back, lower back work than the high bar squat just by virtue of you having more weight on your back.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're doing a little bit less deadlift work, I also think it's probably important for back strength to still be doing some low bar squats. So like...
But we're talking about someone who proportionally has a stronger back to quads.
Sure. So, I mean, you might be able to maintain.
If they're doing enough to maintain, and like we said at the start, it's only a matter of a couple of sets a week, a few sets.
Yeah.
It's not a huge disparity. We're not going like 2 sets of deadlifts a week and 30 sets of squats, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Okay, well, I just want it on the record.
Let's say the program before was 15 sets of each.
Yeah.
Over the week. Like you might now shift to
18 and 12.
18 and 12.
Okay. Yeah. Well, in that instance, cool. But I just want it on the record that I think you should do the competition lift a little bit almost all the time. It's just that little bit can be a very little bit a long way out from comp.
Agreed.
But rarely do I think completely dropping it is the best idea.
Very rarely will I get my lifter to go entirely away from the competition, all three competition lifts. Sometimes pause bench. But
that's pause bench. Shout out JP who
very,
didn't like not doing much.
Very, very rarely will I go entirely away from the comp lifts.
Yeah.
Even for like a 4 week block.
Yeah, yeah.
But there is merit to doing it.
Yeah, maybe straight after comp you can do your 4 week block of just like, you know, have fun and don't do the comp lifts and just like, you know, refresh a little bit. But like you actually have to do the thing you want to get good at eventually.
Yeah, of course.
Okay, so we spoke about high knee extension demand. Lifts, we spoke about creating some room in terms of your recoverable volume. What about choosing lifts for like on technique days for this? So let's move away from just the general hypertrophy phase.
Mm-hmm.
We're now actually talking about how would you structure a strength phase to help repattern this movement. What lifts would you select in which slot and why?
I'm not going to talk about slots, but I'm going to talk about one particular exercise which I really, really, really like and I think has helped a lot of my lifters recently.
Yeah.
Is tempo squats in both directions.
Why both directions?
So the issue happens for someone who has weak quads, they've always shifted sort of back from the knee, from the bottom.
Yeah.
Going slow on the way up gets you to think about where your pressure is. So this may even be not a weakness thing, it may just be like a cueing and a balance thing.
Yeah.
But it really teaches you to hold the bar, like hold your shape where it is and let your knees and hips come together on the way up versus like one way or the other.
So it's that movement precision thing we were talking about before.
Yeah.
See, I almost invariably do tempo squats only on the descent. And the reason is because I want to teach people to like hold that foot pressure and actually feel their way out on the way down. And then on the way up, I'm fine with people actually exerting force and trying to be explosive.
Mm-hmm.
It's not to say I don't think it's a good idea. It's just almost invariably, I don't use them in that way.
I use just the negative as well.
Yeah.
Like we said before, I think the negative is probably more important than the ascent
in
the squat. But for some people, I've found that going slow on the way up like really, really reinforces like what they are supposed to be doing.
See,
and it might only be like 2 sets a week or something.
Yeah, fair enough. So my preference for that same purpose is my favorite squat variation at the moment, which is pin squats. And the reason I like pin squats, I get people to control to the pins, no clatter, pause, and then come back up. The reason I like them is because if your weight distribution is poor or if you're not driving straight up and keeping your knees under the bar off the pins, the bar just won't move. Like it feels awful. You actually really have to drive straight up. And so getting down there, it actually allows you to feel, oh shit, I've redistributed my weight back too far. You feel like you're having to fall forward to start pushing again. And so when you like when you break up that eccentric to concentric phase, you learn where do I have to be to start pushing, how am I going to break this bar off the rack, and you can do that while still actually trying to exert a lot of force and push hard off the pins. Whereas it's not that I've chosen not to use tempos slow on the way up because I think they're bad. It's just I think this is a potential advantage that pins have over them, is that you get to produce high forces and try and do it quickly, which is closer to the competition lift.
Yeah, you can definitely get a lot more weight on the bar.
Yeah, and so like I kind of like I do slow descents onto the pins as well with people, because I say that no clatter thing. I think you get the benefit of learning your descent and then learning to feel, fuck, I'm having to shift to drive the weight back up, and then actually learning that drive line. So I just think they're a really useful tool to learn like all three parts of the squat, you know, descent, position, the whole ascent.
I think there's definitely merit there.
Yeah.
I don't use them a lot because we only have one.
Yeah, it's a pain in the ass to do.
It's kind of a bit of pain in the ass to set up.
Shout out Kato, let's get a power rack instead of the Jacob's ladders.
No, let's not. Let's get another Liga rack.
Another Liga rack with really high safety.
What would Robert Wilk say about pin squats, Will?
Oh, he hates them.
Why?
Stretch reflex.
Yeah, it kills the stretch shortening cycle, apparently.
Yeah, okay.
Kills it.
Calling out Rob Wilkes, it's not how it works. it's not how it works at all, Rob. And if you're still doing other squats, then you'll be fine. Yeah, I like pins. When I use things like pins or tempo squats, though, particularly during like a strength phase, I try and think like, what is the purpose for which I'm programming this? And this is true for all lifts and something we've said a few times. What's the purpose with which I'm programming this? And then how am I going to load it so that I achieve that purpose? So particularly when it's something like we're just trying to introduce correct patterning, it obviously needs to be heavy enough that it's not easy, but you don't want it to be so heavy that people do it poorly, because what's the point in getting people to do something so that they do something well and then having them do it badly?
Yeah, you know? That's why we do technique work that's light.
Yeah, exactly. Like, yeah, if your technique work doesn't have a few reps in reserve and look clean, then it's not technique work anymore. It's just like, it's just crap volume, basically. And so
junk.
And so I might do things like do my main squat loading day, load it however it's loaded, which should normally still be looking good but hard, and then follow it up with a little bit of pin work. Or I might do a little bit of pin work, like on the last episode, my program example, a little bit of pin work sub max, and then follow it with some sub max squats to reintroduce rhythm. Or have it on a separate day, sub-max, where it's like that day's deliberately not as challenging, so I'm recovered to do my heavy work later. Yeah, I might do that. And then, do you still think there's a place for like sort of quad-biased general strength work here? Like, would you ever do heavy high bars as well, just to keep that extra quad stimulus, Alex? Or
yeah, I do. I do think that you can sort of... Let's say you had two squat days, and I do this with... my squad lifters, yeah. Two squat days, one day low bar, one day high bar, yeah. And that will continue like all the way through. The high bar will generally be slightly higher reps,
yeah.
But as we get close to the competition, they'll start to drop into sixes and fives and stuff.
Yeah.
So I do think there is merit there to sort of really loading through the quads and like getting some weight on the bar. So yeah. Long as obviously you can maintain knee position, which is obviously what we're trying to go for.
Yeah, I often have people squat 3 days a week. Literally because I want to have the 2 days where it's like overloading and, you know, overloading with a purpose. But then I'll have a third day that's easy, where it's like, it's deliberately really easy, literally just to practice patterning. And it's not like, it's not 100% necessary to have that third day. I just think it can be a really useful training arrangement. So like, you know, before your secondary deadlift day, have easy squats just to get people to do that. But it's pretty much the same arrangement. Like,
yeah, if I were to feel the need for a third squat session, I'd just throw it in after the easier squat session, like straight after it.
Yeah.
So it might be like the main squat day on the Monday, low bars, and then on the Thursday, high bars, and then followed by tempo squats or whatever whatever I feel is necessary after it.
Yeah, I just think so long as you can preserve the quality of the reps and still be recovered in time for your heavy work,
yeah.
Either distribution of those would be perfectly fine.
I think if you're going to do it as a secondary movement on the same day, it probably has to be loaded another 5% lighter.
Yeah, which is still fine.
Yeah.
But there might be benefit to having an extra day's practice as well. So I guess that's a horses for courses thing.
Yeah.
All right. Very quick break. Another sick jam from the weekend, and then we'll come back for just some programming fads.
Just quickly introduce yourself.
My name is Arjun. I'm Uber driver.
Yeah.
I have done over
13,000 trips in yep. Uber platform.
Yeah, and he's top 1% drivers in Australia. So I'll count us in. 1, 2, 3, 4. Then we just go, yeah, the weekly weights. Yeah, the boys. Ready? Yeah,
okay.
1, 2, 3, 4. Yeah, the weekly weights. Yeah, the boys.
No! Oh!
Welcome back to Weekly Weights. Load the plates. I'm Alex. Here with Will. We're going to talk about some fads in programming. I guess some of these aren't really, like, I guess, very current. But yeah. Fads that, you know, in the last 10 years or so. We're going to start with the Bulgarian method.
Yeah.
So, Will, you want to explain, first of all, what it is?
Yeah, okay. So, Bulgarian method, I mean, strictly, it's not even a thing in powerlifting. There was, so, Abijayev, is
that? Yeah, Ivan Abijayev, RIP.
Did he die?
Yeah, last year, man.
Okay, RIP, because, yeah, badass. He had his weightlifting team working up to maxes in the clean and jerk and the snatch, and all variants.
And squats.
And squats. Every single day?
Twice a day.
Multiple times a day. And when he says work up to a max, it was like a full-on ball buster. Like, you know, you have to do this.
Yeah, Max Ada tells stories about training sessions where he would go in and he would point at a guy and say, you do not leave until you snatch 180.
Yeah, like...
And they leave, they keep you in the gym until you make a lift.
And so, like... So people are like full on maxing out like all day, every day. And people have sort of adopted that. Okay, that's a really short explanation. There's much better ones. But people have adopted that system for powerlifting, particularly for the squat for one reason or another. And some of them have said it's been very successful, but with a few caveats. When most people talk about the Bulgarian system for powerlifting, it's not at all the same. They're not actually maxing out multiple times a day, and they're not even maxing out. They're not going to like a full grinding 100% max. They're talking about working up to a heavy single that might be like in the opener range most days here and there, going for a PB. So first things first, just as a fad, is most people aren't actually doing anything remotely close to what Bulgarian weightlifters were doing when they say they're doing the Bulgarian system. But I guess the more important question to answer is if you were going to go and just work up to, you know, a daily max or a heavy single every day, Alex, when do you actually think it might be appropriate, and how would you do it?
When it would be appropriate would probably be during a competition block. So maybe in the last 5 or 6 weeks leading into a competition, probably no longer than that.
Yeah.
And the reason for this would be trying to create, I guess, technical proficiency under close to maximal loads.
Yeah.
Like very often.
Yeah.
It sort of becomes one of those things where like you just get very desensitized to load, and you just get good at moving heavy weight like very often all the time. So you're kind of always prepared for competition in a way. A way to structure it would be to sort of, I guess, put RPEs on your singles and structure the week in that you're not doing the same sort of difficulty every day.
Yeah.
Because otherwise you just, like, you'll just get ground into the ground.
Yeah, it's like you could do, like, literally wave it, like, single at 7, next day single at 8, next day single at 9, single at 7.
Yeah. And probably wouldn't be doing it daily either, maybe 5 times a week.
Yeah, but, I mean, how many modifications to a system do you have to make to apologize for its flaws before you just say it's a really stupid way of training?
What we're doing is essentially making it not the Bulgarian system. So essentially it's just squatting every day, something, a single hard.
Yeah, so I reckon
it's not the Bulgarian system.
It's not the Bulgarian system at all. So I would be very, very leery of saying let's actually do daily 7 times a week heavy squat singles. But if you did want to incorporate singles into your training regularly, then I think doing it during a peaking cycle could work really well. I agree with Alex. I think it's a dumb idea during developmental phases. And
why do you think that?
Because I think there's benefits to concentrated volume. I also think that you can just handle more volume by just doing lots of fives and things.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't see the point in working out to a heavy single when you're like 20 weeks out from competition, just so you can drop back and do like five fives at 60% of it. Just do the fives, do more of them and rest more. Because I don't think the single has a huge amount of carryover benefit. So
yeah, but you just mentioned fives, which don't exist in the Bulgarian system.
Yeah, so that's my point. Yeah. Is people already say, I'm going to do Bulgarian training. I'm going to work up to a single at seven. Yeah, drop to 60%, do 3 fives just to get my volume in.
Yeah.
Just fuck the single off and actually write a training program. It's lazy to just say, I'm just going to work up to a single every day.
So I think the major flaw is, I guess, that there's no phasic structure.
Yeah.
And we're not developing any qualities during a block. There's no goal of the block. It's just like, do a single every day all the time, make it really hard.
Yeah.
So like, it's quite hard to get better that way for a long period of time without breaking or without using a lot of drugs.
Yeah, but plus side, like we said, really good practice for competition. So yeah, could be used intelligently during a peaking cycle, maybe if you didn't do it.
Maybe if you did it, not it.
Okay.
Smolov, Will?
Oh, Smolov, everyone's favorite. So if you don't know Smolov... If you don't know Smolov,
more,
good.
Better or worse than Bulgarian?
Better.
I'd say better.
Better?
Yeah.
Nah, because I think you could do the Bulgarian system without getting hurt long term. I just don't think it would be smart.
No, you couldn't.
Well, as in, like, if we did it the way we just said, whereas I...
So not
the Bulgarian system. Look, equally silly. So Smolov's 4-day-a-week training program, and I believe the days are structured something like, what is it, like 4-8s... 4 sevens, 6 sixes, and 10 triples, or something like that. Like four high volume days, and they're loaded stupid. The 10 triples are meant to be at 90%, and supposedly are the legit thing. This is talking about the base mesocycle. There's actually like a 13-week small off program. Then there's like a 4-week one that people run called the base mesocycle. Super duper high volume at relatively hard intensities. Mythical program that people say gives them really great gains if you can complete it, and you're meant to do it and gain heaps of weight at the time and put on heaps of muscle. Look it up if you want to read it. A few reasons I think it's dumb. One, because it's just way more work than most people can handle. It's not to say that you couldn't. And most people who do it also do it off a training max, which means you're not strictly doing it how it was written, but it's much smarter to do that. But the intensities are just way too high, and the load progression is way too high. But the two most important reasons that I don't think it's smart. Number one most important reason is just injury risk, because it's an extremely demanding program. And number two, I don't think that doing a program that hard will stall you out and make it impossible for you to progress later. And I've written about why I think that's the case elsewhere. But what I do think is that you accumulate so much fatigue that it makes it hard to train productively in the short term after. And I don't necessarily think it's an intelligent peaking block either. So I just think it's one of those things where you bury yourself for probably limited extra return, as opposed to just training intelligently and progressively, and in a way in which you have to actually take a lot of work away from your other lifts to even get through it. So you do that all with the risk of great injury for, no huge returns. Alex?
Yeah, what we were speaking about earlier is that there is a certain amount of volume which you can do, and then once you get past that level, the amount that you get back is very little per extra unit you do.
Yeah, until the point in which you literally don't get better at all. It's just a waste of your time.
Yeah, this is an example of 4 very, very hard sessions every week for 13 weeks.
Yeah, well, it's meant to be like, I think it's 3 or 4 weeks in the base mesocycle, and then like transition block where you do plyometrics and stuff, and then back into it. Yeah.
Okay, well, we won't go into that.
Yeah, let's not bother.
But yeah, it's too much work to expect the amount back of the effort that it is, I guess.
Yeah,
it just doesn't seem worth it unless you're like, have really great work capacity and you are eating in a massive surplus and you're trying to gain a bunch of weight during it.
Yeah, I guess actually probably something that ties Bulgarian and Smolov training together is that people are attracted to programs that are really sort of a bit out there and have a name and have a reputation and a mythical reputation. And in both instances, there might be ways, like I'm saying this generously, I don't really think I would ever use them, but there might be ways in which you can intelligently apply them. But there's every chance that it's not going to be intelligent for you, the listener. And so grabbing a program just because it has a name or a reputation and running it without any consideration to your actual needs or capacity to execute it is not necessarily smart. And if you're actually making gains doing 8 sets of squats a week at moderate difficulty, then I would look at like making those 8 sets more intelligently structured, or,
maybe do 10 sets.
maybe do 10 sets, maybe fix your technique a little bit, rather than saying, I'm going to run something crazy for 4 weeks and expect a huge return from it. Because that's not the way it works. Like, the name of the program has nearly nothing to do with how well it's going to work.
A lot of the time we see people who have had huge success with these programs, and a lot of the time they will be the genetic outliers who would be sort of successful running any sort of program.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
So if you're the sort of average person who can do the average amount of work and et cetera, don't do small.
Yeah, don't try and do an exceptional amount of work when it might not even benefit you. It's just a sadistic way of getting better, probably slowly anyway. Yeah.
All right. Just because something is hard doesn't mean it's helping you.
Yeah, and on an extremely... That was a smooth transition, Alex. Something that's hard but maybe not helpful. German volume training. What do you think? What is it?
It's 10 by 10.
Yeah.
What's the loading?
I think it's meant to be at 60% and it's meant to be with short rests, but I don't know if anybody actually does that. I think they just do 10
and by 10. And what's the progression?
I don't even know. Do they add weight every week?
That's the thing, though. Like, where do you go from 10 by 10? What do you do?
11 by 10, I reckon.
What do you do?
You've got to have that stepwise volume progression until you're doing 20 by 10 and then you can add weight. No, I think it is 10 by 10 with a little bit of weight added every week. To be honest, I haven't even read deeply about it because pretty much the same criticism that I have of Smolov, which is that it's an excessive amount of volume. It sounds hard. It's cool because it's on paper looking symmetrical. You could write out a nice little like Punnett square of it, but it doesn't necessarily conform to the needs of the lifter. And just like I was saying, we've both said now that there's like an amount of volume that you need to do. There's also a threshold difficulty, which might not be exceptionally high, but there's a threshold difficulty at which your sets should probably be, whether it's for hypertrophy or for strength training. And if you need to accumulate a shit ton of fatigue doing junk volume before your sets are getting appropriately hard enough to actually stimulate hypertrophy, which I think is going to be the case if you do 10-10s flat loaded, then you're almost wasting your time and you'd probably grow just as much doing like 4 sets of 8 and actually progressing them. You know, I suspect, because I don't think your return on the dose is going to justify you doing 10 sets of 10, and I think, yeah, at least half of them are going to be a waste of time. So, yeah, there's that. I think the volume prescription is probably excessive for most people, and it's very low specificity to powerlifting. Although, again, to be generous, during a hypertrophy phase, doing very high volumes might work. I just don't think 10 sets of 10 is likely appropriate.
What is supposed to come after the 10 sets of 10?
I don't know.
10 chunders.
I don't know. I look, like honestly don't know. So I'm gonna gonna be generous and say there might be something intelligent underlying it. I just am at a loss as to figure out what.
GVT to me seems like a workout and not a program.
Yeah, I would agree.
It's something that you do once.
Yeah.
And it's very hard to progress from 10 sets of 10.
Yeah.
We can't really overload from there.
Yeah. And this is actually like literally my pet, I want to get it on a t-shirt, training peeve. Training, like, honestly means nothing if you don't progress. And it doesn't matter, what you're training for. The whole point is to get better. And the only measurement of your improvement is an actual measurement of your improvement. So, you know, if you're measuring your arms, they're not getting bigger and you're training for arm size, you suck. But if you're not going to measure your arm size, then you actually need to see long-term some progression in the loads or volumes or something that you're lifting, you know, for like a comparable exercise. So your bicep curl, like if you're doing 3 10s at 20 kilos and then in a year you're doing 3 10s at 30 kilos, very likely you've gotten bigger. And so again, just trying to maximize work at the expense of actually getting better at the work that you do is really stupid. And really the reason that you want to do more work is because it facilitates you actually getting better. So if it's not facilitating you actually getting better, then don't do it and go away.
Yep.
Yeah.
Something that I say to my lifters all the time is that, and I think I've already said this on the podcast, but too easy is better than too hard.
Yeah. I mean, provided you get better.
Correct.
Yeah. It's like if you do easy work and get better, it's like the best of both worlds.
Yeah. If you can train and it's really not that hard, and you just turn up to training and you just 12 weeks later, you're stronger than you were 12 weeks ago. That's great.
Oh, actually, you know what? Yes. This is, I've wanted to say this for ages. Lifting weights is, it's the hobby that shits me the most in the world. People complain so much about how hard training is, even though everybody who does it like bar, pretty much none, does it as a hobby, right? So you're there of your own volition, spend all your time training about how hard it is, going on the internet and telling people. No one who plays guitar complains about their bloody wrist being sore or their fingers having calluses. Nobody who surfs says, you know, I got a little bit cold today and had to put on a cold wetsuit or something. Nobody does that, except people who lift weights. They're always whinging about how hard it is, how sore they are. Then the second you say to them, and they're there in the interest of getting bigger or stronger or something, right? Then the second you say to them, okay, let's do a tiny bit less and actually get you better, they start whinging about how they're not doing enough work and it's not hard enough. It's like, well, why are you doing this? You're doing this so you can whinge to people about how hard it is, PS, no one cares, or you're doing it to actually get better and it's your hobby. So like, you know, why don't you actually see some return on investment and some progression in your own hobby? Pet hate shits me to death. Oh man, like I'm livid right now.
Will's eyes are red.
Oh mate, like I don't get angry over much, but I get angry over that. Okay, and we're gonna bother.
Yeah.
Okay, final programming fad, which I don't consider it a fad actually. It's been around for ages and been successful for lots of people for ages. But West Side training. So heavy day, light day. Light day is dynamic day. Heavy day is max effort. What's potentially good and bad about it, Alex?
Just like the Bulgarian system, there isn't any phasic structure.
Yeah.
It's the same sort of 4 weeks for a long time. I guess one thing that Louis always says is that his lifters are always ready to compete.
Yeah.
Which is, I guess, one advantage of West Side. Is that they're always handling maximal loads.
Yeah, in case there's a surprise competition.
Loads. Yeah. they're always handling maximal loads. So they're never too far away from competition, which I guess I don't know why, but could be an advantage.
Yeah.
The heavy days are so heavy that it doesn't facilitate a lot of volume being done.
Yeah.
And the dynamic days are so light and such low volume that it, again, doesn't facilitate a lot of volume being done. So there's a big chunk in the middle of, I guess, the 75% to 85% range. 70 to 85% range, which is like probably your bread the bulk. Yeah, it's probably should be the bulk of your training for your whole life.
Yeah.
So it really misses out on the meat and potatoes of what actually gets you better. What else? How far they go away from competition variance annoys me.
Yeah.
They don't deadlift frequently enough, or if at all.
Yeah.
They squat on, like, the bar changes every week, and yeah. the combining like, resistance changes every week, et cetera, et cetera.
Let me be a West Side apologist for a moment, because...
Please don't.
Please don't. Well, like, in the same way that I said, if you change the Bulgarian system enough, you're not really doing the Bulgarian system. The same is true of West Side, but it is perfectly feasible to implement phasic structure with West Side within the confines of a max effort day and a dynamic effort day. It's perfectly feasible to include back off sets on your max effort day. It's perfectly feasible to work up to some heavier weights after your dynamic day. And they do a huge amount of accessory work, and you don't necessarily have to use a huge amount of variation. So I think there's like, if that training style appeals to you, I think there is actually plenty of capacity to do West Side-esque training.
Conjugate.
Yeah. Semantically, it's not even conjugate programming, but that's another thing entirely. But it's perfectly feasible to do it in a really intelligent manner. And
doing it in a reasonably intelligent manner isn't West Side.
Well, it's not, I mean, it's not West Side as per the books and like, you know, elite FTS articles and things. But I mean, that's not to say that the structure is absolute trash. I actually think West Side structure has more capacity for improvement and fixing by a long way than any of the other three that we've spoken about, particularly as pertains to the squat.
Agreed.
Because you already use a heavy day and a light day. It's just much more in the middle ground than them. And, you know, and like I've said, you can absolutely modify those days to make it work out. It's just at some point, you're probably not doing West Side itself. And the things that attract people to West Side, which are, you know, like bands and chains, variations, maxing out every week, are probably not the most intelligent aspects of that program. That's probably my opinion, but like, yeah, I don't know.
If we look at West Side for what it is supposed to be, it's a great program for developing equipped lifters and multiply.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to work for them.
Yeah. Yeah. They use accommodating resistance for reasons of their sport, and that's specific to their sport. So yeah. If you try and do West Side as a raw lifter, you're really not getting the same as you are as an equipped lifter.
Sure. But again, I would just and the, for the sake of generosity, argue that if you were to modify it to reflect the needs of a raw lifter better, you may be able to do okay on it. I would still never write a client a program that I would call West Side.
But training. That takes away from the appeal of West Side, which is, you know, combinating resistance, lots of heavy sets all the time, and speed work on the easy days, etc.
Have you ever squatted with chains?
Never.
I have. It's kind of fun. Didn't think it helped.
Did it get you better?
I was like 18. I was playing footy. So I was just yellowing.
Probably did get you better then.
Yeah, we had... Yeah, anything worked.
But yeah, a lot of the variations that they use in West Side are specific to equipped lifting, such as box squats sitting back into the suit. A lot of tricep work, overloading the triceps.
Yeah.
Much more important in the equipped bench than in the raw bench, etc., etc. So those are things that you need to take with a grain of salt.
Yeah, actually, what's interesting is like probably a theme in how Alex and I would choose secondary exercises to complement the raw lifts are like the things we choose either have a muscular demand that's like, you know, really specific to the lift, or like we use it for a specific technical demand, as opposed to like implementing variation in like the actual the what's it called, the force curve. The force curve, the thing. Oh my god, I've lost my words. You know how like the weight is hardest in the squat near the bottom and easiest near the top, and accommodating resistance
distribution.
Google it, everybody's listening. But you know what I mean, like the when you're doing equipped lifting, because the suit gives you the least at the top, the weight feels the heaviest at the top, and so you know you invert that with you invert that with bands and chains. Strength curve, that was correct.
Instead of force curve.
Okay, strength curve. Rather than doing things to change that or to implement instability or any sort of particular instance of dynamism, we try and do almost like the minimum change required to a lift to actually introduce the variation effects that we want. Or we do a very specific variation to target a very specific technical issue, as opposed to just implementing variation for the sake of like variation itself.
And that's something that West Side does as well.
Yeah,
those exercises and those applications happen to be different because the sport is different.
Yeah, I guess so. Not a huge fan. I'm being generous. I can see how you might be able to do it well, but just most people don't. You got anything else to say? All right. In that case, have we got a review this week? Hope so.
I don't know if we have any new ones, but we have some that we haven't read yet.
All right. Waiting. Oh, that's nice of him. This is T-Mug 101, who was my client.
Oh, he competed on Sunday. Congrats, Timmy.
Yeah, shout out, Tim.
15 kilo total PB.
Yeah. Yeah, was my client, now Alex's client.
Now much better than he was.
Review says, powerlifting gods. Great listen for those powerlifting fans. Nice mix of knowledge given and banter shared. We'll be tuning in for next week. Thank you, Tim.
Thanks, Timmy.
Have a good week.
I've been waking up every morning, just listening to Weekly Weights. I've been waking up every morning, just listening to Weekly Weights. Been trying to tell my baby lifting weights is really good for you. Hahaha.